Hello, my name is Victoria Bamber, and you're listening to Metcast, the podcast that digs into the research, knowledge, and expertise from across Manchester Metropolitan University and how it is transforming the world around us. In this month's episode, we focus on sports and the health aspects associated with professional and amateur activities. First up, join us as we dig into a sporting debate that has dominated the headlines in recent years: the potential dangers of heading footballs and the risk to players' health. We know footballers are 3.5 times more likely to die of diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's than people the same age. We explore research from Manchester Metropolitan University Institute of Sport that investigates what happens in the brain when someone heads a football. So, should heading the ball be banned? Hear what our experts think. Now, how do you feel about running? Love it or loathe it, millions take to the streets every week. With the Great Manchester Run round the corner and a host of events lined up for the summer, we speak to our sports psychology and nutrition experts for some useful hints and tips on preparing your mind and body for a run ahead of the big day on May 21st. But first, let's talk about football and the dangers associated with heading the ball. Sophie Metta sat down with researchers from the Manchester Metropolitan University Institute of Sport, who have been investigating the effects of heading in football in the hope to take a step closer to understanding the lasting health impacts.
The beautiful game, full of passion, rivalry, and emotion. Played by more than 250 million people in more than 200 countries, football is loved the world over. Many will recall the exact moment their team scored that winning goal in a crunch match or missed the all-important penalty. No other sport creates so much emotion and so much debate. United or City, Messi or Ronaldo, VAR to stay or to go. But in recent years, another quite serious debate has dominated the headlines, and that is around the potential dangers of heading in the sport and the risk to players' health. Regular impact on the brain from heading footballs, both in training and in matches, is raising concerns. Many have questioned whether heading should be banned altogether due to the growing evidence it can do harm to the brain over time. According to research, footballers are 3.5 times more likely to die of diseases like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's than aged, matched members of the population. Data also suggests that the risk for defenders, who head the ball most often, was 5 times greater, and goalkeepers, who rarely head the ball, were at no greater risk. But why is heading potentially so dangerous? I spoke to researchers from the Manchester Metropolitan University Institute of Sport, including Dr. Johnny Parr, lecturer in sports psychology, to find out more about this topic and their research.
There's more and more evidence that football players are at a higher risk of neurodegenerative disease compared to the general population, so diseases such as Alzheimer's, motor neuron disease and Parkinson's. And it's becoming clearer that the risk is associated with how frequently someone might have headed footballs across their career. So, for example, outfield players have a greater risk compared to goalkeepers, and players who play in defensive positions and therefore typically perform more headers have a much greater risk of these diseases compared to those in non-defensive positions. Based on this new evidence, there's now been more policy changes. So the FA have attempted to limit how many forceful headers that players do per week. And now there's some restrictions on how many headers children can do at training to kind of mitigate the potential risk.
Dr. Parr and colleagues here at the university have been investigating the immediate impacts of heading in football, as they hope this will take us a step closer to understanding the lasting impacts. Their latest research found that brain function and the way that the brain communicates with the muscles were both impaired in the short term after heading real footballs in succession.
What we wanted to do was provide a little bit more information or insights to kind of how heading immediately affects brain health, because there is growing evidence that actually head in can immediately make us worse at cognitive tasks and make us less able to control our movements effectively. So what we wanted to do was to determine if these immediate effects of football head in might be underpinned by changes in their brain activity. So what we did, we measured brain activity using a technology called EEG and muscle activity during a hand grip task before and after participants performed either 20 headers of a real football or 20 headers of a virtual football where there was no exposure to the actual impact of a ball. We also measured cognitive performance before and after heading using the King-Devick test, which is typically used to screen for concussion. And what we found was that the VR group improved their performance on the King-Devick after their virtual head-in protocol, whereas the people who headed real footballs did not, which suggests that head-in might have attenuated or reduced the ability to improve on these cognitive tasks. We also found that whilst both groups got better at the hand grip movement task, individuals in the VR group displayed a change in their brain activity, which is typically observed as people become more skilled at a task, which usually indicates that their brain is working more efficiently or less effortfully during the motor task performance. By contrast, those who actually headed the real footballs showed an absence of these changes, which could suggest that heading attenuated the onset or the development of these more efficient brain states. Finally, contrary to our expectations, we also found that those who headed the real footballs showed increased connectivity or communication between their brain and the contracting muscles, which in essence suggests that the electrical signals produced by the brain and muscle become more synchronous in how they fire to control movement. And previous research has shown that following heading impacts or head trauma, areas of the brain can become more connected or synchronous, which might reflect a natural response to injury. But importantly, any attempt to explain this surprising finding does remain speculative until we do some more research.
Findings of the study clearly show an immediate impact on brain health following hegging. Not only did those who headed real balls self-report a range of symptoms commonly associated with concussion, but researchers also found an increase in brain muscle connectivity, similar to someone with concussion or mild traumatic brain injury. But what could this mean for longer-term brain health? Well, scientists say we are still a way off from understanding the long-term impacts.
Well, our findings clearly show that heading induced immediate changes to brain function and how our brain and muscles communicate, but it's still unclear what this altered activity actually represents. So, for example, it could be that heading required participants to kind of work harder or invest greater cognitive effort because there was a need to compensate for some deficit, the brain's ability to process information, or it could be that the altered activity might reflect some need to manage the distracting concussive symptoms that people experienced as a result of the head-in protocol. It's also possible that some of our findings could be explained by additional physiological changes in response to head-in that we didn't capture. So, for example, we're currently conducting research to investigate how a bout of 20 football headers changes blood flow to the brain, which could be a contributing factor to some of our findings. Finally, more work is needed to determine the time period or how long these changes to brain function last following head-in, and whether anything about these short-term responses to head impact can tell us anything actually meaningful about more long-term brain health and the risk of disease. So in future, we hope to kind of bridge that gap and provide a more rich timeline of the brain's response to heading impacts.
The football industry has already begun to accept that there are potential dangers to hegging. In 2001, the Football Association published new guidance for hegging during training, recommending that heggers are limited to 10 per session and in only one session per week for both adult grassroots and the elite game. They are also trialling a ban on deliberate hegging in under-12s football and advising against any hegging in training for other youth players. But is banning or limiting football hegging the answer? Dr. Ben Marshall, lecturer in sport and exercise psychology, believes a hybrid approach to training, including some real football hegging and use of virtual reality systems, could provide a solution.
We know that players who have better technique and players who have stronger neck muscles are less susceptible to the damaging effects of heading, of those subconcussive impacts. So the act of heading a football does strengthen your neck and does make you a better header of a football. So by reducing that in VR, you are potentially leaving players open to more risks by not having that physical aspect. So for instance, for the younger players, there's this big jump from under 12s where you do no heading at all in training, but still potentially heading in match scenarios. Then when you go to under 13s and above, all of a sudden you are then heading in training as well. And that's quite a big jump too. So there's risks inherent in all that. It seems that quite likely there's going to be this sort of hybrid solution. where you'd be able to reduce the amount of heading in physical training, but you'll be able to replace some of that with virtual reality instead. So it's similar things that are already done in rugby, in American football, where they reduce the amount of contact, the amount of sort of hard tackles that go in on the training field. They try to limit that and go through more like the tactical, skill-based type things, and then leave the physical side of it, the impact, the injury risk, becomes more part of it on match days.
Researchers here at the Manchester Met Institute of Sport have been using VR in their studies to mimic hegging, but what is the potential of VR to help with this issue?
VR gives this very nice, attractive prospect of being able to practice things that are either difficult to replicate in real life or potentially hazardous to practice in real life. So in the case of football heading, we know that literally heading a football is a subconcussive impact that leads to these potentially long-term neurodegenerative issues like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and dementia and things like that. So in virtual reality, potentially what players are able to do is they're able to still train some of the perceptual cognitive abilities that we associate with football heading. So things like tracking the flight of the ball, getting your timing right, working on aspects of technique to ensure a successful header, but without the risk of actually having to physically head a football. You're instead heading virtual footballs into virtual goals. So therefore removing potentially a lot of that risk that's associated with actual physical contact.
But how effective is training in virtual reality? Well, that's exactly what researchers are trying to find out next.
We've got an ongoing project at the moment where we're looking at the potential of seeing, can you actually become better at heading in real life just by training in virtual reality? So does doing virtual reality training, heading virtual balls into virtual goals for a week of training, does that make you better at actually heading real footballs into real goals, thereby improving your goal scoring opportunities, better defensive performance and things like that? If it does show any evidence for VR being potentially beneficial in that way, then it's this nice sort of indication that you might be able to start using VR to offer this kind of hybrid solution and still look at ways of improving neck strength, improving technique as well, the things that also will help to lower the risk that physical heading has for long-term brain injury, but making it thus kind of a larger holistic solution to the whole problem.
Over the next few months, the team will be continuing their research into the physical impacts of hegging in football, as well as the potential of VR in providing a solution. We'll be keeping in touch to find out what they discover next.
Thanks, Sophie. Now, on to running and those tips and tricks to help beginners and more experienced runners prepare and recover. With thousands about to pound the city's streets in the Great Manchester Run, Lisa McCarthy sought advice from Dr. Martin Turner, reader in psychology, and Dr. Adora Yao, Senior Lecturer in Nutritional Physiology, both from the Manchester Metropolitan University Institute of Sport.
Running. Love it or hate it, it's been a staple of humans throughout history, from our ancestors hunting to the first marathon in ancient Greece. Fast forward to the modern day, and around 7 million people go running regularly in the UK for any number of reasons. Either someone new to running who's looking to get fit, to elite athletes searching for their new personal best time. And here in Manchester, the AJ Bell Great Manchester Run is one of the biggest running attractions in the country, tempting thousands of runners to take part in the annual 10K and half marathon races around the streets of the city, cheered on by thousands. You may be one of them looking to take part for the first time to get fit, raising money for charity, or a seasoned pro, as the event celebrates its 20th anniversary on Sunday, May the 21st. But either way, there are some hints and tips to help you prepare before, during and after the race to help you do your best. And if you're not running, keep your eyes peeled during the race for Team Orange, Manchester Met's team for staff, students and alumni running together in our distinctive orange tops. Dr. Martin Turner is a sports psychologist who works with athletes at all levels to help them achieve their best. We asked him what runners can do to help them mentally prepare for the race.
One of the key things is habits, and just knowing that you've done all you can going into that race can give you that confidence that you need. Knowing that you've prepared well and that you've stuck to a training plan or a diet plan, feeling like you've executed that plan really, really well can give you that really robust confidence going into that event. So that's really important. Also perspective. So this is important because you can put a lot of pressure on yourself going into a competition. So of course you want to do the best you possibly can, but it's really important not to let that slip into I have to do well and I must perform well and I have to record a personal best, because that's just unnecessary pressure. We're using very extreme, rigid language like that tends to kind of increase anxiety when going into an event. Anxiety can be problematic because it can be distracting. It means you're focused on things that might not be useful for your performance. It might mean that it's trickier to regulate your energy and things like that. So most people like to feel composed before they enter an event, not to say relaxed or calm, but at least that they're in control. Being able to manage anxiety is an important part of that. Another key skill that many athletes would use, or anybody really participating in events like this, would be to use imagery, sometimes called visualization. This is where you would kind of see what you're about to do in your head before you do it. And you know, there's multiple ways you can use this. In something like a marathon, where it's probably unrealistic to really sit down and imagine the entire race, you would try to visualize key aspects of the race, or aspects where you know there might be challenges, and you would see yourself coping in those aspects and coming through those barriers. So it's not necessarily always seeing yourself do the perfect race. It's more about seeing yourself get through some of the tricky bits of the race. And there's two aspects to that. One of them is being aware of the tricky bits, and then secondly, knowing that you can cope. And then you piece that together in your imagery, so you actually see yourself through your own eyes, coping with those situations. That can be really, really key. Then finally, it's really important to see the race as a challenge and an opportunity to demonstrate what you can do, and kind of approach it with curiosity. So being curious, being open to learning, seeing it as an opportunity and a challenge to learn and grow and develop, rather than this big threat, this big painful, arduous occasion, which is going to put your body through pain and suffering. For sure, you will suffer and there'll be pain in that race, but it's being curious to know, how well prepared can I get for this race? What can I learn? What can I take from this?
For many, the Great Manchester Run will be their first attempt at a 10K. While more experienced athletes can draw on previous experience to help get them through, what can beginners do to spur themselves on and make sure their first experience is a positive one?
For a beginner, it's really, really important to focus on enjoying the learning, enjoying the community feel that you get from that event. I know myself, having run a 10K, going into that experience, it was more about having a group of friends that were preparing for that event and enjoying the day and being part of a community. And you do see that with some of the bigger, you know, marathon type events, but even some of the smaller events, like if you go along to a park run, there is that sense of community. So as a beginner, it's really important that you focus on those aspects and sort of try to enjoy the experience. We know that people are much more likely to sustain their athletic behavior or exercise behavior if they enjoy the thing that they're doing. If you're going in as a beginner super focused on performance and recording a good time, then there's a danger that you make the experience really one-dimensional. And then when you do have an off day, you tend to fall out of love with running easily, and then you don't participate anymore.
To sum up, Martin shares his top three tips for all runners.
So my top three would be to see the race as a challenge and opportunity, and to use curiosity. I think that's the appropriate orientation to anything important that we experience as athletes or in our jobs. It's, what can I get from this experience? What can I learn? How will this help me to grow and develop? It's seeing that race, that experience, as part of a process that moves you towards something broader and bigger. So seeing it as a challenge, as an opportunity, rather than this big dangerous threat, you know. Secondly, is to mentally and physically prepare for adversity. So it's being realistic and knowing that you will face some adversity. Whenever you have a goal, people aren't just going to let you achieve your goal. You know, you're limited as a human being. The competitions you're going into are uncertain, uncontrollable. You will face some issues and some problems and some setbacks. It's knowing that they'll take place, and then it's preparing for them mentally, seeing yourself cope and understanding what those if-then plans are, for example. And then physically in training, knowing there's certain aspects I need to train for specifically here, doing that in some detail. And then thirdly, it's being balanced. What I mean there is taking perspective. Not saying I have to do well and it's the end of the world if I don't do well and I can't stand failure and I'm such an idiot when things don't go well. It's just being more rational and logical and saying, look, I really want to do well here, but I don't have to. You know, if things don't go well, then I'll just correct. I can move on. It's not going to be the end of the world. And also knowing that you can tolerate setbacks and pain and stuff, you can tolerate it. Human beings are extraordinary, their ability to tolerate these things. It might be tough and difficult, but you can certainly stand it.
We also spoke to Dr. Adora Yao, a nutritional physiologist, who gives us some advice on what to eat while training and in the run-up to the event. Is it as simple as filling up on carbohydrates from food like pasta beforehand, or glucose-rich running gels and bananas on race day? Or is there more to it? She explains.
So during training, athletes should, or runners should, ingest mixed nutrient meals containing higher amounts of carbohydrate and some protein, and then smaller amounts of fat. We want to ingest slightly higher amounts of carbohydrate because our stores are more limited in our bodies. So we have around 400 to 500 grams in our muscle and around 80 to 100 grams in our liver. But we can increase these stores of carbohydrate by depleting them, using them up in a long, high-intensity training session, and then ingesting high-carbohydrate meals after that. So we can then increase our stores to like 600-800 grams even of carbohydrate in our muscles. Previous research has shown that if you do this, that we can make our muscles adapt and take on board a bit more carbohydrate in our stores. In terms of before the marathon as well, so like the few days leading up to it, you want to make sure you ingest more carbohydrate, especially in the morning of the race. So you want to have a carbohydrate-rich breakfast to replenish your liver glycogen stores, because that's important for maintaining blood glucose levels during the race. So after sleeping, your liver glycogen stores would be lower because that would be used up during the night when you're not eating. So you want to ingest a bit more of that in the morning to make sure those stores are topped up as well. For a 10K runner, I would say there's no real need for using gels, just because our carbohydrate stores, our glycogen stores, they can last for around an hour and a half to 2 hours. So for most people, that would be enough sort of stores to run a 10K for maybe an hour and 15 minutes on average, I'd think. For a half marathon, the use of gels can potentially be more useful, especially towards the latter half of the run, as people might aim for around 2 hours to 3 hours for a half marathon.
So when race day comes, most of the preparation is done, but it's still important to think about what you eat, even right up until the minutes before the race gets underway, as Adora explains.
Around 15 to 30 minutes before the race, you might want to sort of preload your body a little bit with some extra carbohydrate. So you could maybe ingest a gel if you've used them before, and obviously, as I say, trained with them, with some water, or maybe a few sweets or a banana or something. So something that won't sit in the stomach for too long, because you don't want to kind of feel heavy and get like stomach cramps or anything at the start of the race. It also takes a little bit of time for whatever you eat to be absorbed. So 15 to 30 minutes is a good time, because it allows for some of it to be absorbed quickly, and it will then be available at the start of the run to be used. So if you ingest some sort of carbohydrate beforehand, you're then going to be using the carbohydrate from the food that you've just ingested, so that you're not using your stores, which you want to try and keep for like the latter end of the race.
But if you eat sweets, gels or bananas before this 15 to 30 minute window, it could backfire.
You don't want to ingest anything too far in advance of the race as well, so nothing sort of longer than 30 minutes before the race, because you want to avoid something called reactive hypoglycemia, which is low blood sugar levels. If you have something high glycemic like sweets or gel, that would increase your blood sugar levels really quickly, and then that would cause insulin to be secreted, which helps take up the glucose from your blood into your cells. That can cause blood glucose levels to fall a bit too much, is your hypoglycemia. Now, when you start exercising as well, your muscles then take up the glucose from your blood as well, so you can kind of get like a double effect, and then you might start off struggling a little bit at the start, so you don't want to take it too far in advance of the race as well. But 15 to 30 minutes means that it's kind of enough time to absorb, but also you avoid this dip in blood glucose levels.
So there you go. We hope this has given you some helpful hints and tips ahead of race day. Be sure to keep your eye out for Team Orange, and good luck on race day.
Thanks, Lisa. Best of luck to our Team Orange runners and everyone else taking part in the Great Manchester Run. Whether you are running for charity or personal achievement, I hope those expert tips will work for you. That brings us to the end of this episode of Metcast, the official podcast from Manchester Metropolitan University. We'll be bringing you a new episode each month, so if you want to hear more from our experts, students and partners, as well as details on the latest research from across the university, be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast platform. Until next time, thank you from me, Victoria Bamber, and the rest of the team for listening.